One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a Swangles and
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I am your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic or you are listening to us wherever podcasts are served, we certainly do appreciate your support. We know you have a lot of options out there and we're humbled that you would choose to spend some time with us. We have two sponsors for the show, Curiosity Stream. If you are into documentaries like I have watched them all, it seems, on Netflix. If there's a prison documentary that's been made, I've seen it four times, guaranteed. Curiosity Stream has thousands of shows available, high definition quality. You can stream it on your laptop, your TV, your phone, your tablet. It's $2.99 a month. That is 10 cents a day. There's absolutely no excuse to pass on information like this. We also have Scribd. If you're into ebooks or audiobooks or e-magazines, check out Scribd. You can subscribe for the first month is free, $9.99 for every month after that. Unlimited access to so many books from major publishers, you won't even have enough time to read it all. Any support for our sponsors is also counted as support for us. We certainly do appreciate it. There will be links in the description box below, so check them out. Well, it's kind of nice to have the most dangerous man in America on as one of your guests, because I don't mean dangerous in a sense that he's going to hurt you. I mean dangerous in the sense that the establishment doesn't care for him because he is destroying their fairy tale, the fairy tale which is 9/11. And of course, I am talking about the head of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, Richard Gage. Richard, how are you?
I'm doing great, Charlie. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. And it's funny, we came into each other's orbit in a roundabout kind of way. I was at Benny Will's wedding. They're just sort of getting ready for the post-ceremony, getting ready for dinner, and I see Richard Gage. And in my head, he doesn't know who I am. I know who he is. And I say to him, you know, I wrote a book, and you're in my book. And your response was, cool, that's cool. I said, I don't think you will quite understand. I have a chapter in the book that's called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I mean, you're really in it. I am so enthralled with your work. I think it's the most important work that's being done out there. And yet sometimes you just have to acknowledge that the universe is a very mysterious place. And to get seated at dinner next to a guy who I wrote a chapter about in my book, I apologize for talking your ear off for 2 hours, but I figured, you know, you may never get this chance again. So you gotta get into it. So thank you for being on the show. And then of course we parlayed that that wedding into me talking to Jeff Berwick and saying, why haven't you had Richard Gage at an Acapulco? This seems like such a natural fit. Like what? And his response was, oh yeah, you're right. So you guys right. got together, and next thing you know, we're all in Mexico and I'm watching you on stage in front of who knows how many people, 2,000 people. And I mean, everybody was paying attention. Those conferences, you know, people are on their cell phones and they're going outside to get a drink and whatever. There was 100% participation and attention in that meeting room when you were talking about 9/11, because I think most people understand that this is the most important event in our lifetimes. And if it had happened the way it was supposed to have happened, then that's one thing. But when you start to expose that the lie, the foundation that this lie is built on, is rotten, and that because of this lie, we have then gone forward into two major wars, five other external wars, a reduction of our rights through the Patriot Act, and everybody kind of wasn't really sure when 9/11 happened, you know, what we were seeing. We had never seen airplanes fly into buildings. We didn't know what that would look like. We didn't know that the buildings would come down. We were kind of at a loss. But there was this one building that didn't really get talked about. It didn't add up. And for me, I have been, you know, I've talked about how 9/11 was the event that woke me up in general, but Building 7 in particular. And your work on Building 7 in particular has thrown the official narrative into the garbage. And for that, you are probably, that is why I consider you to be one of the most dangerous men in America. So tell us how do you go down this path? I mean, how do you take it from this seems fishy to me to I'm going to start an organization and we're going to get to the bottom of this?
Well, thank you, Charlie. Quite an introduction there. I was shocked upon hearing David Ray Griffin in 2006 on the radio. He was being interviewed by Bonnie Faulkner's Guns and Butter program in Berkeley. And I'd never heard any alternative theory as to how these towers came down. And I was just dumbfounded. I had to pull my van over in this parking lot. And I'm going, I'm listening to this. You know, I'm on my way back from a construction observation meeting. He's talking about these first responders, all of them hearing explosions, seeing explosions, feeling explosions. And this is, you know, well after the aircraft hit the towers and before they came down. This is a wild story. The ends of the beams being flown 600 feet in all directions during the collapse of these buildings. And then the ends of them being on fire is like molten metal, pools of it. Of all this evidence, I'm going, what are you talking about? I would have heard this. And then he had the audacity to try to tell me that a third tower came down. I'm going, what are you talking about? Yeah, I learned that a 47-story skyscraper in the afternoon of 9/11 at 5:20 p.m., about 7 hours after the Twin Towers came down. This building drops like a rock, uniformly, symmetrically, straight down into its own footprint in under 7 seconds. And I'm going, what? So I had to go see this, right? So he was speaking that night in Oakland at the Grand Lake Theater, but they were sold out. There were 600 people like a couple of nights later. And I had to go home and watch on the live stream. But I saw this building coming down and going, a third tower? You know, we never heard about this. So sure enough, there's 11 videos of this, and it was played actually twice on several times that day on mainstream television, but not since, except for twice. And so, you know, this building comes down exactly like the old hotels in Las Vegas. So we've all seen those. So we all know what a controlled demolition looks like in that case. And yet most architects and engineers today don't know anything about the third worst structural failure in modern history. I mean, think about it. There's 40,000 tons of structural steel in this building, and all of the steel had to have been removed instantly for this building to have come down symmetrically, as fast as a bowling ball falling out of the sky, free fall acceleration. So this doesn't happen by fire, which is what they tried to tell us in the official report 7 years later. Normal office fires. You know, office fires have never brought down a skyscraper. So we before 9/11, all of a sudden we have three on 9/11. So that got my attention that week. I spent, you know, weeks researching this. The guys that I worked for, 15 other architects, 14 others at the firm, thought I was nuts as I was talking about this stuff. But I put together a presentation based on the work of Stephen Jones, a physicist formerly from Brigham Young University. And he had done some work on Building 7. I repackaged it. I took it to them and I bought them pizza, bribed them to come in and watch this. And they did. And all of them at the end of that presentation agreed, oh my God, you're right. Not only Building 7, but the Twin Towers too. Explosive controlled demolition. So we had 15 total architects now, 14 at the time, signed on to my petition. My boss wouldn't sign because he was Middle Eastern and very concerned about his reputation. Now we have 3,250 architects and engineers demanding a new investigation. So we're on our way, Charlie.
That is phenomenal. And you and I have talked about this a couple times, that I love, as somebody with a marketing degree who worked at an advertising agency, I love what you did on the anniversary, your campaign. Did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? Simple question. It's not confrontational. It's just to the point. If your answer is, I did not know that a third building fell on 9/11, well, your world is about to be turned upside down, because it's one of those things that once you know it, you can never unknow it. Once you see it, you can never unsee it. And I lived in Las Vegas for 9 years. I still work. I still go back and forth. I've seen plenty of hotel demolitions. They like to rig them with fireworks and put on a show, not unlike the show that was put on 9/11, I would suggest too. But you don't need to be an architect or an engineer to know when you see something that looks peculiar. And that Building 7, that the kink in the top of it when it starts and then the symmetrical fall, it's just, you know, people will say, well, what are you? Were you an architect? No. And I don't feel like I need to be to use the eyeball test to see that that building came down in a very unnatural sort of way. Now, I will give them a pass, so to speak, on built on towers 1 and 2, because to see them come down, it's possible that we could say, well, look, we don't know what a building looks like after it's been hit by a large airplane and the airplane's in there for a while and then it comes down. So does that look normal? Who knows? But Building 7, a couple things. First, just the eyeball test of it coming down symmetrically has got to send, you know, red flags up. But secondly, it's the fact that the the media pretended like it didn't happen, that the 9/11 commission or 9/11 omission report didn't talk about it. I mean, that's criminal. Well, first of all, they tried to put Henry Kissinger in charge of the 9/11 commission, which should be, you know, that right there is a gigantic red flag. I guess people went bananas and they told him to take a hike. But still, people have described that report as, you know, or the 9/11 commission as being set up to fail and underfunded, which of course it clearly was. When a book comes out that's this thick talking about 9/11 and it fails to mention that building, that leads me, and I think other people, to the assumption that they don't want to talk about it, that there's something about that building that wasn't supposed, that they would prefer we just forget about. Now, of course, we're not going to forget about it, but the corporate mainstream media has done everything in their power to pretend like it didn't exist. And if you are someone to question that, then you are a tinfoil hat conspiracy theorist, which I don't mind being called. But the reality is that that's a pretty inaccurate way to describe people that are just pointing out that one of the largest buildings that would have been, I guess, the largest building in 40 different states just came down, and we're just going to pretend like that didn't happen. That's alarming and media malpractice to pretend like that didn't exist. So here we are 19 years later, almost. And where are we with this?
One of the things we've done is hire the University of Alaska to engage in what's now a four-year, $300,000 study on this building. And what they've done in their draft report is completely pull the rug out from underneath NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, who was tasked by Congress to explain all three collapses to the American people. And they didn't do that. They didn't do that with the Twin Towers at all. They didn't explain the collapses. They were supposed to analyze the capability of the cold, hard steel underneath the point of jet plane impacts to resist the upper portion of that building, those buildings to exceed the capacity of that structural steel. But they stopped at the initiation of collapse. That's hidden in footnote 13 on page 82. Of their 10,000-page report. They had their own agenda. And so we have a huge problem with that. But the report focuses on Building 7 from the University of Alaska. And they found that the only way that this building did not collapse by fire, they proved that. Fire couldn't even cause the initial deformations of the steel that NIST had claimed caused it. And they claimed that by omitting key structural elements to help them fabricate this theory of the initiation of collapse in the northeast section of floor 12 in this building. But the University of Alaska modeled the whole building with their false assumptions, and it didn't collapse. Then they modeled it with the true assumptions, and of course, it didn't collapse either. And then they said, well, what could we do to get this building to collapse in the way that the videos show that it did, which is symmetrically at free fall acceleration. By God, they had to remove all 80 columns on each of 8 floors virtually at once, you know, within a second of each other. So, of course, what can do that? Fire does not do that. Instantly removing columns, only explosives can do that in what we call controlled demolitions. So this report is now the most dangerous thing out there besides me, with its author, Leroy Halsey, one of the top forensic structural engineers in the country, and his team of PhD researchers, hoping the danger has moved over to those guys. But they're going to be traveling around the country now presenting this. We're starting in the D.C. area at some major universities there at the end of March.
Why University of Alaska Fairbanks? Were you just trying to get as far away from Washington, D.C. as possible?
No. A supporter of ours had approached this chairperson of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering there, because he was in the same town, and he had to approach him like three or four times to get him interested. Finally, the guy got real curious, of course, because, you know, he says, well, they're similarly designed buildings throughout the world to Building 7. So although it has some unique characteristics, its basic structure from the fifth floor up is where the initiation started on the 12th floor here, allegedly. It's very similarly designed. So we have to make sure the buildings in our country are safe. So he approached it from an ethical point of view, given that other analysis of this building did not approach the modeling, computer modeling, with integrity at all, as he proves in this 128-page report entitled Reevaluation of the Collapse of World Trade Center Building 7.
So if NIST says that it was a problem, you know, through their modeling, they've decided that it came down one way. Did they issue any sort of new guidelines for retrofitting of buildings similar to this, or building construction going forward? I mean, if it was such a catastrophic failure, right, wouldn't they then have to go in and make some sort of new restrictions or new guidelines for engineers moving forward to prevent something like this?
Yeah, you have the unprecedented collapse of a 47-story skyscraper. By normal office fires, you'd think that all the engineering and throughout the world would be massively affected with tougher codes for the structural design, but not one of the structural design recommendations that NIST did make were accepted by the International Conference of Building Officials for their International Building Code. So that's a huge telling omission, lack of response. From the industry, we know our buildings are safe. We haven't had a problem other than this. So I think what they did is effectively ignore NIST.
Hmm. So did University of Alaska Fairbanks take any time to examine towers 1 and 2, or did they specifically focus on Building 7?
Just Building 7. Yeah. But with the attention that this report is getting on Building 7, and that we'll get when the final report comes out near the end of this month, we will be making every engineer in the country aware of it. We are sending out 50,000 postcards to announce the final report of this building to the civil engineering community, which includes all the structural engineers. So we expect a lot of attention. And that eventually we will turn our attention to the Twin Towers, because we do now have the structural drawings in our hands for the Twin Towers, and we can begin modeling those. And we are.
Cool. Well, so the owner of the complex, Larry Silverstein, is on record on a PBS documentary saying we had such terrible loss of life. We made a decision and we thought the best thing to do was to pull it. So we pulled it and we watched the building come down. Pull it being a engineering term for taking a building down. He's saying that. We've got videos of firefighters walking away from the building moments before it went down, saying, "Get those, you guys better back up out of there. That building's coming down. That building's coming down." So you've got you've got the countdown, the recording of a countdown saying 4, 3, 2, 1, and then it comes down. All of these point to a controlled demolition, including the owner of the complex saying, "We made the decision to pull the building."
He says they made the decision to pull the building. And he was referring to the firefighters who don't pull buildings. Right. Right?
But even if the firefighters did, let's just play this scenario out. You get hit, towers 1 and 2 get hit by a plane at 9:30 in the morning, and building 7 comes down 7 or 8 hours later. In the best of circumstances, if you had a team of 1,000 people, could you rig a building for demolition in 7 hours?
Oh, no. No, it takes months of planning and engineering to engineer and place these explosives. You know, you got to get near the columns and beams connections at a minimum in the core of the building. Thousands of shaped cutter charges we're talking about. And the evidence, by the way, shows that these are not high energy explosives in Building 7, but thermite based apparatuses. So because we have pools of molten iron seen by so many, we have the evidence of molten iron droplets in all the World Trade Center dust, which are unexplainable in the official story. We have in the case of the Twin Towers, molten iron pouring out of the South Tower minutes prior to its collapse. So this evidence just piles up enormously. Plus, the U.S. Geological Survey finds in all their studies billions of these previously molten iron droplets that they can't even explain, but there are so many of them. There's about 4 tons of them in the World Trade Center dust. They call them a signature component, the EPA does. In other words, it's not even World Trade Center dust unless it has all these previously molten iron droplets that they have no speculation about where they came from at all. And then you have this team of 8 international scientists led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen who find red-gray chips in all the World Trade Center dust, again, amounting to about 4 tons of this material or more. And the red layer is composed of iron oxide and aluminum powders. But these powders are, at the nanoscale, they're 1,000 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair. So this is very sophisticated material. In fact, they test it, put it in a differential scanning calorimeter, and at about 758 degrees Fahrenheit, they ignite, producing what? Molten iron microspheres, the same ones found by the USGS, who wouldn't speculate on where they came from. Same chemical signature, though. So you see, we have this internally consistent, self-corroborating set of repeatable experimental data that could put a lot of these perpetrators away, the real perpetrators, probably not Muslim fanaticists who wouldn't have had access to the most highly secure buildings in the world outside the Pentagon.
So what is the difference on a scientific level between thermate, thermite, and nanothermite?
So thermite, first of all, has been around for over 100 years. It's just rust and aluminum powder, and you ignite it with a very high temperature striker device. Its thermite grenades are used by the military to destroy steel, like tanks and stuff. And it's been used at least once in history to bring down a steel tower in shaped cutter charges. So thermate is much more effective at cutting through steel. They combine sulfur now with thermite, and it becomes thermate. And interestingly enough, not only the ingredients of thermite are found by the U.S. by FEMA in their Appendix C, in the original report, May 2002, the Building Performance Assessment Report on Building 7 and the Twin Towers, they find that the steel has been partly evaporated in extraordinarily high temperatures, unaccountable by kerosene, which is jet fuel, or by office fires. So they have hot sulfur corrosion attack on the steel, thinning it to razor sharpness, putting silver dollar size holes in the steel from Building 7, which they very carefully documented in a metallurgical examination. But when NIST took over this whole investigation in 2002, they throw out that Appendix C metallurgical examination, and they don't talk about the molten iron, the hot sulfur corrosion attack on the steel, molten iron invading the grain boundaries of the steel, which was so very carefully documented by FEMA and the team from the university. I forgot the name of that university. And Professor Sassoon and Jonathan Bartlett. That's not the right name. Jonathan Bart something. Anyway, might be Bartlett. So it's just fascinating the cover-up that NIST was engaged in here. And then they don't talk about this incredible temperature attack on the steel at all. So thermite can do that. Now, nanothermite is a whole other animal. It's been developed prior to 9/11 and subjected to peer review in academic journals. It is called super thermite. It takes thermite, iron oxide and aluminum powder, and manufactures them under extraordinarily complex laboratory conditions, made only in the most advanced defense contracting laboratories, by the way. And it makes a more explosive material out of an incendiary, which thermite normally is. By reducing its size to the nanoscale, its surface volume is increased exponentially. And so you have instantaneous chemical reactions, which can be responsible for the explosive effects that we see in the World Trade Center. But we also believe there were high energy explosives there too, which are blowing out after the first 4 seconds when we have this telescoping in a destruction of the upper portion of each of the towers above the point of jet plane impacts. The whole steel structure is basically liquefying. And then after 4 seconds, you have these incredible explosions, which are blowing these 4-ton and 8-ton structural steel sections laterally outside the towers, 600 feet in every direction, trailed by thick white smoke clouds. Well, steel beams are not flammable under office fires or jet fuel conditions. What has caused the extreme flammability of the ends of these steel beams, ejected laterally at 80 miles an hour, laterally, you know, gravitational collapse, which we're told the World Trade Center towers were, gravity works down. But here, there's no, hardly any of the steel, maybe 1% of it, found at the base of either of these towers. All the steel is outside the footprint. By the way, all the concrete is pulverized to a fine powder in midair. All the videos and photos show this, and it drifts laterally in a 3-square-mile around lower Manhattan, 3-square-mile area. So if the steel is well outside the footprint and the concrete is way outside the footprint, what's left to crush the building? That's 3/4 of the weight of this building. There's nothing left. It's all virtually been expelled outside. So the official story makes no sense no matter what angle you approach it from.
So I think the best way to describe it is that the buildings weren't falling down, they were blowing up.
Especially the Twin Towers.
Yeah.
Sabotaged with explosives and or incendiaries in the first 4 seconds, allowing the top part, 15 stories in the case of the North Tower, to telescope inside of itself. And so we could call that blowing up because fire doesn't cause the destruction of all the columns and the beams at once virtually in the building. Same with the South Tower, which was hit 30 stories down, which did begin to tip over, but with the dissolution of the structure of the top box or section above the point of jet plane impacts, it begins to right itself. Well, then after that, you have you have asymmetrical damage from the impact of the airplane into the tower. You have asymmetrical damage from the fires. You have asymmetrical damage from the destruction from this load that's tipping off. So how can you have complete symmetrical destruction all the way down the face of the building, just like the 156 firefighters who were recorded by Thomas von Eschen, the fire commissioner, in 2005. We didn't have this information until then, even though they were recorded a month after 9/11, 500 first responders, but this was kept hidden by the city of New York. And finally, the New York Court State of Appeals forced them to release this information to the New York Times, and they publish all of these witnesses of explosions, and they say wrapping around the building like a belt all the way around. And by the way, most of these witnesses of explosions are very clearly their transcripts are very clear. They talk about explosions immediately before the towers come down. Again and again and again, there's this very distinct order of events. Many of them see flashes of light at different floors. And then the tower comes down, they're talking about, just like the old hotels in Las Vegas. So yes, that's very explosive after the first 4 seconds, blowing the entire contents of the building outside the footprint versus building 7, which is a classic implosion where it just folds in on it itself. Like the old hotels in Las Vegas, it's very very directed, very controlled versus the uncontrolled nature of the towers explosions.
Well, there's video of firemen that are going, you showed it in your presentation. I think a lot of people have seen it before. The fireman that goes to a payphone and is on the payphone and he says to the other guy, "Hey, you want to call your mother?" And then you hear this ba-boom, this very distinct explosion that wasn't the plane hitting the building and it wasn't the buildings coming down. It was somewhere in between that. So it's tough for the official story to explain away the fact that there are explosions coming from the basement levels of the buildings. People heard them. Lots of people heard them. People have them on video. You can watch the videos and hear the explosions. So I just have a hard time understanding how the official narrative can continue to push, you know, that it was just due to office fires in Building 7's case, or these, you know, two planes flying into it, when there is irrefutable proof that explosions are happening in the basements of the buildings before they came down. So,
as well as credible witnesses, which you cite here, the ones that the firemen at the telephone booth are actually hearing explosions after the towers came down. You can tell by all the dust on the street, but before the Building 7 came down. Interestingly, corroborating witnesses of explosions in Building 7. Yeah, altogether, we're talking about hundreds of witnesses of explosions, and not one of them appear in any of the final reports by NIST.
Wow. And the lateral ejection you talked about, there's images of beams being stuck in neighboring buildings that look like arrows that are sticking out. Gigantic steel beams. I'm no physicist, but it's got to require a tremendous amount of force to eject something that large, that far, and at such a rate that it's sticking through the neighboring building. And yet we see this everywhere. We see the dustification of the building, which can't be normal. I don't remember any implosions in Las Vegas where 4 months afterwards you still have fires in the rubble.
Well, you got three things here. You've got the expulsion of steel, the dustification, and the persistence of the fires. Let's take them one at a time, because I don't want you to get too far ahead of me. This is important. Remember those, because I'll forget them. Okay. Number one, the steel is ejected laterally, and it has been calculated by physicists. Physics teacher David Chandler, in particular, calculates that it's enough energy to hurl a 200-pound cannonball 3 miles. This is an extraordinary amount of energy. These are 4- and 8-ton structural steel sections, and they're going laterally 600 feet. So how does that happen? You know, that can only happen with incredible explosive force. Gravity works down. Regarding the dustifying, yeah, pulverization of 90,000 tons of concrete in midair is done by high energy explosives also. And we hear those explosives. Well, hundreds of first responders heard them. And they're all, not all of them. The cream of the crop of them is on our DVD called 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out, where we've gotten together 40 high-rise architects, structural engineers, metallurgists, chemists, physicists, that's the one, controlled demolition experts, all laying out this evidence. And it's free on YouTube. You can watch the one-hour version. And there's a one-and-a-half-hour version with an extended set of interviews on a second DVD, if you want to get that in our store. And then you mentioned the persistence of these fires. Yeah, the fires didn't go out for 3 months. It was mid-December before these fires went out. Well, what's burning down there? It's not paper. The paper would have burned up in a day. So what's really happening here? We've got incredible evidence for thermite incendiaries and nanothermite laced in all the World Trade Center dust. And much of that molten iron, the first responders are saying, flowing down the channel rails like a volcano, like lava in a volcano. So they're seeing this. They produce these meteorites that are being pulled up, multi-ton fused molten metal and fused molten concrete. I didn't even know concrete can melt, but there's a piece of this in the police museum. It melts at 3,200 degrees. Guess what kerosene burns at? 600 degrees in open air, according to the jet fuel manufacturer, which is, again, jet fuel is just kerosene. So we have nothing in the official story that can possibly get anywhere near to accounting for this incredible heat, as well as the persistence, what you're talking about. Did I cover that for you, Charlie? Yeah.
Well, does thermite, how is it getting its own, how is it getting oxygen to burn down in these piles? Is it creating its own oxygen? What's the physics behind this?
Yeah, thermite burns underwater. It has its own source of oxygen. That's the iron oxide, where the oxygen moves from the iron to the aluminum and producing aluminum oxide gas. So that's where the oxygen is going. It burns just as well underwater. So it's used for underwater demolition type situations also.
Well, I've watched the video interview of Danny Jawenko, who is a Dutch explosives demolition expert, and he's being shown the video of Building 7. And the guy who's put the laptop in front of him doesn't tell him anything about it. He just says, take a look at this building, let me know what you think. And he sees it come down, and he said, that's a controlled demolition. He says, are you sure? He says, I'm positive. He goes on to explain how that is, and then the guy tells Danny, what you're seeing is a building from 9/11, and this happened on the day of 9/11. And the look on his face, with him trying to wrap his brain around how that can be, says it all, really. He just keeps saying, are you sure? And the guy's saying, I'm positive. Are you absolutely positive? I'm positive. And he just said, that's a controlled demolition. Experts took that building down. So
yeah, and then he says, well, they must have worked very fast, because he knows it's a controlled demolition. Yeah. He's just trying to work it out in his mind how that could have happened. And of course, it doesn't happen in an afternoon, especially when a building's on fire, right? This takes months, as we talked about. You have to get into the core columns. Now, in the case of the Twin Towers, we have the largest elevator modernization going on the 9 months prior to 9/11, the largest one in the world. Just before 9/11, 85 employees of ACE Elevator were in the building, and they fled. They didn't stick around to help the firefighters rescue these victims, and the elevator cabs are the key rescue vehicles in a fire, and for use by the fire department only. And so this was quite a scandal documented in USA Today. But the elevator modernization itself was documented in March of 2001 in Elevator World. So this certainly could have given a group of operatives because Ace Elevator came out of nowhere to get this contract from Otis Elevator, who installed and had been maintaining these buildings up until that time of this new elevator modernization. Access through the gypsum board hoistways that they just simply had to cut through and then get to the core columns and beams in the Twin Towers.
For those of you that sign up through our sponsor, Scribd, you can get access to Elevator World, I'm sure. If you're missing your monthly subscription to Elevator World, I'm sure that's an exciting publication. So you've got a building. So one of the things that we discovered afterwards is that, I guess people in New York might have known this, but the common person didn't realize that the two buildings, towers one and two, were filled with asbestos, and they were supposed to remediate that asbestos to get it out of there. And that apparently was going to cost, the numbers I've heard is upwards of $1 billion, making this a kind of a building that doesn't really pencil out financially. So you've got elevator modification in a building that really actually needs asbestos removal first. You've got Larry Silverstein taking over the lease of this about 2 months, 3 months or so before this happens, getting
2 weeks.
2 weeks. 2 weeks. Oh,
sorry. No, you're right. My fault. 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
Nothing now.
What? Getting insurance to protect it from terrorism. And then what do you know? We have an event in which a terrorist event happens. Larry Silverstein decides that his wife has scheduled him a dermatology appointment for that morning. He can't make it there, or otherwise he would be at Windows in the World having breakfast like he normally does. All of these coincidences happen. And we're just supposed to accept this as being normal? It seems that we've been conditioned to believe the media, whatever sort of, I put this in my book, that there's a weird thing that happens when the media throws out the first story and that becomes the official story. And then every other story is saddled with the task of knocking that one off the, you know, like a downhill skier in the Olympics who goes first and their time goes up there. They're number one because they're the first one, and then every other skier has to knock that time down. This official story, the way we're conditioned to believe it unquestioningly, just take it at its word, it seems like maybe back in 2001 we were the type of people that would maybe just take their word for it, especially in an event like this. We're trying to make sense of it all, but 19 years later, now what's our excuse for looking back at this and believing the official story? There's so many holes in this story. If you had a friend that told you this disjointed story, you'd never believe them. You just wouldn't. So why are we so trusting of what the government and NIST and the media and the White House and all of these people have to say that contradicts just what our eyeballs tell us? What is the psychology of this?
Yeah, this is an area that we delved into in the DVD that you showed there, where we interviewed 8 psychologists after presenting all the evidence. Because, you know, this evidence can shatter our trust in our government. It did for me. That was a big blow. I mean, I was very supportive of the effort to go into Afghanistan and Iraq and get those bastards who did this to us, right?
Right.
Brainwashed. So we're brainwashed that, you know, America can do no wrong. And if we do, we apologize for it, although I've never heard an apology. We have a great deal of faith. It's a nationalistic faith. And David Ray Griffin calls this, it's a greater faith than the Christian faith, even. We're that brainwashed. And to have that faith contradicted is heresy. So what you and I are speaking right now is heretical, and we get angry responses from immediate, visceral anger a lot of times. People get so angry because we've actually tried to insert a vector of truth that actually turns their world upside down if they entertained it. So many can't. Therefore, also, if they don't get viscerally angry, they dismiss it. They say, if that would be true, I would have known about it by now, right? How logical is that? That was the logic I used, by the way, when I heard David Ray Griffin trying to tell me that a 47-story skyscraper collapsed without me knowing it on 9/11. I would have known about it by now. And I get the same response from other architects and engineers. But there are those who, for whatever reason, have more of an open-mindedness, who are able to listen, open-minded to evidence that makes sense to them. And all this evidence that we provide is, you know, straight from official sources, most 90% of it. The U.S. Geological Survey, FEMA, all these sources available on 9/11, video of Building 7 falling down. We didn't make that video. So they kind of have to listen and then at some point, this evidence works its way inside of them and they begin to ask the question, as I did, what does this mean? If these three towers were blown up, oh, well, the Muslims got inside them and blew them up. You know, we still cling to the faith in our government that it couldn't go there. And then when we actually look at the logistics of how Muslims would have had to accomplish this, all of which is impossible, not because Muslims aren't smart, they are, but it would require massive inside operation intelligence support. So even if Muslims did do part of it, say they were flying the planes, for instance, which has been disproven as well, Muslims on the whole, or even radical Muslims in part, couldn't have made this happen. So we're left with an inside operation here, which is traitorous, mass murder, treason, is what we're talking about. These, if they got caught, they could have gone to jail. So they had to have a complete cover-up system in place, starting with governmental agencies like the 9/11 Commission, which was formed only reluctantly after a year, and massive prodding on the part of the Jersey widows. Then they would have had to have the media involved. Well, I learned after this that 90% of the mainstream media is controlled by just six corporations, now five. And who runs those corporations? Well, it turns out to be the same individuals and boards of directors that control the corporations in the arms industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, the insurance industry. They all work together for their own benefit, not the benefit of the American people, and certainly not any idealistic virtue or based on values that you and I adopt as inherently. So something else is going on. Our country's been hijacked, Charlie, and nobody knows this more than you, as the author of The Octopus of Global Control. So I won't delve into there too much, but you might have something else to say about that.
Well, it's interesting with the media. There's the overt lies, the lies that they tell us straight to our face, and then there's the lies by omission. It's the important stories that they refuse to talk about, and that leads you into the way you view David Ray Griffin's information. If this had happened, I would have heard about it on my nightly news, and that's sort of an old way of approaching the news. I think it's, you know, my mom, you know, that generation, they trusted the news. They liked Tom Brokaw was their guy. And because, you know, we watch him and we, you know, if he's going to give it to us straight and if he's talking about it, it's important. And if he's not talking about it, then it probably didn't happen. And so we go about our lives and which makes you have to ask the question, did you know a third tower fell on 9/11? And the reason why you have to ask that question is because they didn't talk about it in your nightly news. They didn't ever talk about it in the papers. They just pretended that didn't exist. And therefore, it was a lie by omission. So it's a devious way of omitting important information to shape a narrative. So you can shape it by lying about it, or you can shape it by omitting some aspects of it that would obviously make a difference. If they had told us from the start, these two buildings were hit by planes, but there's a third one over there, we're not really sure what happened to that one, then everybody would start digging into it. But as you mentioned, the media has a lot of overlap with some of these other large corporations, the interlocking board of directors. Then you've got companies like General Electric, which have stakes in both NBC and arms manufacturing companies. And so we understand that war is good for business, and that creates problems for us because we don't necessarily give a damn if Raytheon or Lockheed Martin stock goes up. We're interested in not spending money on attacking countries that didn't do anything to us. And it creates this gigantic, it creates cognitive dissonance where we just start to shut down. When you get too close to this truth the first time around, you just kind of say, what am I going to do about it? Really? I don't need to know about 9/11. I can't do anything about it. I don't want to know about it. I got to pick my kids up. I got to go, you know, to work tomorrow, and I can't worry about this stuff. So I can understand the psychology of how it creates a barrier in your head. I don't respect it, but I understand it. And nowhere has this been on display more than, in my opinion, than on 9/11. And nowhere is it more needed for us to wake up to this than on 9/11. And there has been, you know, there's no organization that's doing more for this than Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. I was going to say in the history books, you know, you'll be written about in the history books, but that probably won't be the case because the history books are controlled. But the people that in the future, we will look back on the exposing of this lie. There will be several players that will be responsible for making the public aware of it. And I think Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth will be one of the prominent reasons for the lie collapsing. Whatever comes of that, whether that's roundups and people put in prison or whether it's just a rewriting of the history books to make it more accurate. The work you've been doing is so important. I think that it's also important for people to know that they can donate to you, to your organization as a 501c3 corporation, which is tax exempt. And the irony of donating money and getting a tax write-off for exposing the government's lies about 9/11 is just so juicy. And I love that so much. And I encourage anybody that's watching this or listening to this to take a look. Listen, if you have more money than time, give some money to AE911truth.org. If you have more time than money, then take some time and share this information as far as you can. We can't leave it up to social media. We can't leave it up to YouTube. They're shadow banning. They want this information to go away. They've been totally compromised. They work for the establishment now. This information is very inconvenient to them. And so it's up to us. It's up to us to support it financially, to support it with our effort. It's to talk about it. Don't talk about it at Thanksgiving dinner like I did. That's a bad idea. But any other time you want to bring it up, it's important because so much of it, if we rewind the tape to that day, so much of what we're living in now with Patriot Acts and endless wars and trillion-dollar deficits and troops coming home and shooting themselves and a million dead Iraqis and displaced people, all of this is because of 9/11. And when the story of 9/11 is untrue, then you have to examine what that means. It has massive ramifications for not just us, but the entire world. So it's the most important event of my lifetime. It's the most important story that everybody's getting wrong, except for a handful of people. And I just think that what you're doing is so important and needs to be shared with everybody.
Thanks, Charlie. I certainly agree. And people can share the link simply to the website, which is AE911truth.org, and they can also share the report with the universities in your area. The draft report is downloadable from our website, which at ae911truth.org/WTC7. And so there's just a lot that people can do. We have, if you're one of those people who likes to hand out brochures in the street, we have 100 brochures for $10 or something. All the evidence we talked about today is in it. It's packed.
Well, I want to remind people that questioning 9/11 is not disrespectful to the victims. It is, in fact, the exact opposite of that. It is disrespectful to not examine this obvious lie. It is disrespectful to just pretend that everything is fine and that that happened a long time ago and we're moving on from that. Re-examining 9/11 is the most respectful thing you can do to the victims. It is your duty to do this. And I just feel that, you know, there's a weird way that some people look at this, that you're, you know, it's in the past, or don't do that to the victims, or you're marginalizing, that you're not supporting the troops by doing this, or you're not being patriotic, or all these really weird ways of look. It's like, no, we're exposing a lie that cost millions of people, trillions of dollars, untold, you know, incalculable negative will against America, and who really did it? If it's not 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters, then who did it? And that's something that we're going to try to figure out. And Richard, you are one of my favorite people. I just love what you're doing. Thank you so much for jumping on this call and for getting the truth out. I know you've done this 1,000 times, but you never know when you're going to wake up the person that takes it the next step. So this is why we keep talking about it. We can never stop talking about it.
No, we can't. We can't stop. We got to accelerate. As a matter of fact, people are waking up in greater numbers. It's very exciting. So we'll never stop. We just keep going.
Awesome. He's Richard Gage. Check him out. I'll have all his links in the descriptions. We love him. He's the best. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Charlie. Thanks, everybody.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org. ATI.org.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.